good to go already. Good timing. All right, this week, divine impassibility. Anybody know what that means? Any guesses on what it means? All right. That was a great guess, but that's not it. It does not mean silence. So, I'll tell you what it means in a minute. But this, as a preface, this is my favorite one out of them all. This is what I did my thesis on at Union. Don't ask to read it, it's terrible. I read it in preparation for this. Oh my word, I didn't even know I wrote that, I could write that bad, that not long ago. But I really love this one. It is very, very interesting to me. And it changed a lot about what I thought about prayer and just who God is in general. So I hope it does the same for you. So Second London Confession. We've read this part several times. There's a lot of stuff we get from it. But when it says, a most pure spirit, invisible, without body, parts, or passions. That's what we're talking about, or passions. So what does it mean? It specifically means, this is what it specifically means, that God is not able to suffer. He is not able to suffer. But when they started using this kind of language to describe who God is and attribute it to God, they meant more than just that he did not suffer. They meant passion as in subject to passions. So more than suffering. So here's a definition that a guy named Paul Fides says about this. I disagree with this conclusion, but what he says it is really accurate. So he says, Aquinas likewise claims that suffering as a feeling is also impossible for God. All emotions are excluded from God because as passions, they arise from receiving something from an external force through the senses. In other words, suffering as an emotion is prompted precisely by the stimulus of suffering as an impact from the outside. Okay, that makes sense at all. I'll read the important part again. Mm-hmm. All emotions are excluded from God because as passions, they arise from receiving something from an external force through the senses. Okay, so they meant that God does not suffer, but it's more than that. What we're saying is, God is not able to experience pain or pleasure emotions in as caused by another being or another thing. All right. Weird, right? Maybe you haven't thought of God in these types of categories before. I certainly haven't. This may be helpful. I'll read part of this. This is in Matthew Barrett. His chapter on this is the most helpful I've ever read in my life. So what does it mean for God to be impassible? God is impassible in the sense that he cannot experience emotional changes of state due to his relationship to and interaction with human beings and the created order. Or he says, think of it like this. God is impassible in that he does not undergo successive in fluctuating emotional states, nor can the created order alter him in such a way as to cause him to suffer any modification or loss. Or you could add gain, loss, gain, any sort of modification. All right, with that being said, this is a very brief description of what it is. I really want to hear, how does this settle with you? Does it concern you? Does it bring up any questions, make you feel kind of weird about talking about God like this?
Well, I think I immediately kind of got confused because then I was thinking more about Jesus.
Yes, okay.
Like, oh no, wait, we're talking about God the Father.
Yeah, it gets tricky. We're going to spend time there for sure. So if there was one doctrine within classical theism that I think is the most disregarded today, it's probably going to be this one. And here's the reason why. When God is described in the way having no emotional change or anything like that, or can't be affected by creation in an emotional way, it really frustrates people because they want a God who is like them. And they want a God who is very relational and close and personal and emotional. And so when they think of a God who's impassible, They think of a God who's unrelatable, who's cold, who's distant, who's far off, who isn't near. And maybe you feel this way after we talk about it. But it's my hope to show you that it should actually be the exact opposite. Hopefully by the end of the class, whenever you think about, is God impassable and how does that make me feel about who he is, it should make you think, no, he is very relatable. He is very close. He's not cold, distant at all. And the impassibility really pushes that forward. All right, any thoughts or questions so far?
How does this impact the Father's response to the Son on the cross?
We're going to talk about it.
Okay.
I'm devoting time to, because every time I talked about this when I was at Union, like within 2 seconds, people were like, but Jesus. And that's a good question because he suffered. I mean, we know Jesus suffered. So we're going to talk about it and how that works. All right, I want to give 2 examples of popular people who do not hold to this. And I want to show you how they do it. The first one is subtle, and it's not that egregious, and we agree with him a lot. It's J.I. Packer. He wouldn't hold to this exactly. He would kind of make some nuances. And then there's a guy named Moltmann. We do not agree with him on a lot of things. But I want to show you what he says. It's pretty violent. It's pretty not good, but we'll talk about it. All right, so this is what Packer says. Packer explains that God's experiences do not come upon him as ours do, for his are foreknown, willed, and chosen by himself, and they're not involuntary surprises forced on him from the outside, apart from his own decision, in the ways that ours are. So he's going to say, no, God totally has experiences, he totally has emotions, but in his ordaining will, he's made it so that he actively brings it up at the right time that someone is causing him, or would try to cause him to feel a certain way. Does that make sense? So it's like he's working out his own will and his emotions and how he feels before and with a foreordained plan that aligns perfectly with what we would cause him to feel. Does that make sense? Sort of, maybe not. So he's going to say God's feelings are not beyond his control as ours often are. Theologians express this by saying that God is impassible. That's not exactly true. We're saying more than that. They mean that he is impassive and unfeeling, but that they mean not that he is impassive and unfeeling, but that he feels like what he does is a matter of his own deliberate, voluntary choice. So, yes, but also we're saying more than that. It's more than just that he is in control of his emotions in a really, really incredible way. It's more than that. We're saying that God is not subject to feeling or emotion, period. So Packer's gonna do it in kind of this little like theological, you know, acrobatics and try to get here in a different way. It's not entirely wrong, but what the classical theist of old, the older theologians, they're pushing it further than what he's saying. He's gonna kind of make some reservations. So that's the first one. Have you ever, what do you guys think about this? Does it sound right? Does it sound wrong? Can we say that God experiences at all?
Would you say that this is an accurate analogy then? That, like, just like our nerves to the body, so our feelings to the soul. Like, our feelings, like, just like we use our nerves to interpret the world around us. Mm-hmm. Our feelings that we have help us interpret, like, what's happening to us spiritually, or is that inaccurate?
Sort of. I'm going to give an analogy here in a minute about stubbing our toe. And that is nerves and emotions all tied up in one. And I think it's going to address your question. So if it's cool, I'm going to wait till we get to that. And I think we can answer your question. Yeah, stubbing your toe may be the most theological, mind-blowing thing you're going to learn this morning. All right, so the second one is a guy named Moltmann. You're supposed to go, boo. No. He's 96 years old, still living. I looked it up. I was curious. All right, so this is what he's going to say. Let's see here. All right, so he's going to talk about, this is specifically, he was writing, he's German, so he's going to talk about where was God during the Holocaust? That's kind of one of his big things that he's going to talk about. And what he says is, Where's God in the Holocaust? He's right there in there suffering with them. He's in the concentration camps suffering right alongside them. And he's going to say, when people are being hanged in the gallows, where's God? He's hanging right next to them. He's going to go so far as to say that any other answer is blasphemy. To speak here of a God who could not suffer would make God a demon. All right. So that's how far people are willing to go the other direction. And he's going to do it in a very, very, like, I mean, it's a pretty forceful way of saying it. To say, so what he's saying is, if I think that God is impassible, and I do, I'm making him out to be a demon because he's not suffering in the camps with the Holocaust victims. That's pretty intense. What do you think about that? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Because there's this part of it, right, that's like, maybe that's kind of comforting to know that God is right next to me going through this and experiencing with me. Or is that not comforting? What do y'all think? Why is that? Is that not comforting?
So why? What does he do with all the accounts in the Old Testament of what happens to the Israelites?
I don't know. I wouldn't be able to give you an honest answer. I'm not a scholar on him. I do not want to be.
How did Packer and this person, I forgot his last name, I'm sorry. How did they reach these conclusions? Like, what are they basing it on? Like,
I think Moltmann is... I think a lot of it has to do with he wants a God who's a lot like him. I mentioned this joke one day, but it's funny. It says that in the beginning, God created us in his image, and ever since then, we've been trying to return the favor. In other words, we just constantly try to make him out to be like us. I think it's because we find it more relatable, more comforting, even though that's not true. So I think Moltmann's driven mostly by emotion. And Packer, I'm going to say that he probably, I don't know, I don't want to be dishonest with him. I'm not sure why. He's pretty close, but I would disagree just slightly with what he says. All right, any other thoughts?
I would say you want someone stronger with you when you're going through a problem. I mean, like, if I was sinking in the sea, I wouldn't want somebody beside me.
That's right.
I want somebody up above me to pull me out.
That's right. No, that's exactly right. That's why I think what Moltmann is saying is it's not good. So I want to talk just briefly, sort of a case as to why I think God is certainly impassable and some implications. But we're going to spend the majority of the class looking at rebuttals because I think that we'll learn it best when we hear what people say against it and then why we can still confess it to be true at the same time. So the case for why God must be impassable and some implications. One, this is not even close to a new thing. The earliest of early theologians, they held this. This is not a thing that's been made up recently because people want to be creative or anything like that. It's been here for a long, long, long time. This is who they thought God was. So, not new. All right, and if what we've said so far in the class is true, then this must also be true. If God is simple, if he is self-sufficient, he is unchanging, he has to be impassable. You can't have an emotional change of any sort in a God who is not composed of parts, who is entirely self-sufficient, and is totally unchanging. Any emotional change in there, you got to make a compromise on one of them. And maybe that's fine, but you're just going to have to be honest about it and just admit, I just don't fall in with any classical theism, because if you start breaking off one, you got to kind of break them all. In other words, yeah, if you're going to have to take an exception probably on God's immutability the most. If you want to deny this one, you're going to have to do that. Another thing is that, does anybody remember what we said? God is pure, blank, three-letter word. God is pure something. It starts with an A. Act, yeah. God is pure act. In other words, there are no potentials. In God, everything is actual, or you could say God is. But this is the way that I think it's helpful to say it. All right, nothing can be activated within God. Specifically, we're talking about emotions today. But there's no emotional part of who God is that can be activated by something that we do, if that makes sense. Mm. Now, there has to be questions at this point. Make you feel there's nothing in God that can be activated to do something by us.
It's good. I mean, he can't be any better than he is.
That's right.
And so we say, like, well, if I'm suffering and God sees that, then he's gonna suffer with me, and his emotion to me will be roused, and he'll be even more loving and more kind to me than he already is. And that sounds like, well, that's not a good thing. But it is a good thing,
yeah.
Because if he wasn't already as good as mm-hmm. he is, then,
no, that's
then
exactly
why not?
Right. That's exactly right. Mm.
I think, too, if you take it the other way, like how much we sin against God, mm. then knowing that we can make him angry and then having him be angry at us and, like, not be able to show or maybe show more anger than grace in a moment, would be scary to think about.
The best answer I've ever heard. No, really, that's exactly right. I'm partially joking, but I'm not joking. That is exactly right. She was with me when I did all this thesis stuff, so she probably knows it better than me. All right, so let's do 5 questions or rebuttals. And hopefully if you have questions that you're just too afraid to ask, maybe I'll accidentally catch one. So the first one is, does God have any affections at all? Or can he even love? If God's impassible, he's not subject to any emotions, does that mean he can love at all? Does he have any affections?
The Bible describes it as such sometimes, you know, God so loved the world.
Yep, that's going right there. It definitely says that God loves the world. So how do we make sense of a God who isn't subject to any emotions, but also at the same time is loving? It's kind of weird. And this is how I think the best way to do it is. All right, so you have active affections, and passive passions. Some older theologians will say this affections and passions, but I add those words because I think it kind of makes it a little bit more clear, and they just really worked with the A's and the B's. So, active affections and passive passions. So with active affections, we're using analogous language here. For example, for God so loved the world does not mean that God was moved by us in our pitiful state to send his son to die on the cross for us. He was not moved because he saw how miserable we were down here. He's like, man, bless their heart. I'm going to send my son. You know, that's not what he did. It's an act of love that supersedes an emotional response by our state. It's beyond that. This was an affection that was within God, and it came from nothing apart from him, totally within himself. It is not something that came upon him. He, you know, felt the urge to do. He felt like he really needed to do. Felt sorry for us. None of that. It is totally active within God. We're using analogous language and saying that he so loved the world to send his son. It's the best way we can communicate it. But it is not the same as me saying, I love ice cream. So here's an example of how we could do this, you know, poorly. If I say, I love ice cream and I love my wife, it's the same word. We're meaning very different things here. Similar, kind of a similar situation. We're kind of just, the word love here, he does love us, and he does love us enough to send his son. But we're not meaning it in the sense of, you know, pity to love or anything like that. Totally active within God. Does that make sense? All right. So passive passions. So here's the stubbing the toe thing. A passive passion is like the lights are off in your house, you're walking to your kitchen, and you catch your toe on the leg of your couch. You are overcome with pain and emotion. There's nothing you can do to not experience what you're experiencing emotionally, physically, spiritually, everything that's going on. You feel it, and you feel it deep. And if you could not feel it, you wouldn't feel it. But you do. You've been impacted, and it has taken a hold of you. That is what a passive passion is. And there is none of that within God in any way. Beyond, you know, inflicting pain, there's nothing around him that he can stumble into in any way that would ever cause him to be a certain way or change who he is. So you have active affections and you have passive passions. Any questions so far or thoughts?
Would compassionate be active then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, that's right. It would be.
Because we know our Lord is compassionate.
Yep. And we'll talk about it a little bit more when we get, I'm going to mention mercy. But Isaac has said this a few times. With compassion, it's not him changing in relation to us. It's us changing in relation to him. And we call that God's compassion towards us. That's not him changing his disposition towards us. It's us changing in relation to him because of something that happened.
If I can just steal a second on that attribute, Jonah is a great place to go look at it. Of course, I picked a smaller look at it. All right, so Jonah's the, you know, God tells Jonah, go declare, I'll destroy the city in 40 days. He goes and repents, and God doesn't destroy it. So it looks as if God changed. He was going to destroy it, and then at a later point, he doesn't destroy it. All right, where's that? Sorry.
It's okay, we're not on a time limit or anything.
I know. All right, where's this? Anyway. Yeah, paraphrase, Jonah complains to God. He says, I knew you were compassionate, slow to anger, abiding to steadfast love. That's why I didn't want to go.
Yeah.
He knew God was going to do that.
Yeah.
So it just shows that God's compassionate the whole way through. It looks as though God's mind changed, but he's compassionate before and after, and Jonah knew that.
So would that be the same with, like, when it talks about him, like, burning with anger towards the Israelites or
yes.
other groups in like Exodus and stuff?
No, exactly. So we're going to look at a text on the second rebuttal that specifically looks at an Old Testament text. We're going to make sense of it. So how does this affect God's love? So he loves in a perfect way, not an emotional way. So oftentimes what happens is we define love as this thing, and then we say, God is that, this thing that we've created, this love. Instead, we say, God is love, and so this thing over here, that is love because it reflects what God has said it is. And so, in other words, his love is perfect, and it's not tainted like our love is. And so, when we say that God, to say that this makes God unloving is to try and define love apart from God, and then say he doesn't fit it within your definition, essentially is what's happening. And that's just not the way that we should do things at all. And that's how we can kind of make sense of how God can be loving, and also not subject to emotions. So the text I want to look at is Deuteronomy 9:8. I won't turn there, but I'll just summarize it and say that essentially what it's saying is God was provoked to anger because he's referring to what happened with the golden calf situation. He says, I was provoked to anger. All right, so what I think is happening here is we're learning this is anthropopathic language. So we talked about anthropomorphic. That's attributing human characteristics to God. Anthropopathic is describing human emotions to God. That's what we're doing in this situation. He was not actually driven to anger in the same way that we would be driven to anger if someone did something to wrong us. So here's an Aquinas quote. I think this is helpful. Anger and the like are ascribed to God by a metaphor drawn from their effects. For it is a characteristic of anger that it stimulates men to requite wrong. Divine retribution is their metaphorically themed anger. In other words, God does not get red-faced angry when people do things that disobey him. That is not who he is. But rather, we see the repercussions of what happens when you disobey God and his will. Whenever you don't obey what God commands, and then bad things happen, that isn't because God is like actively in the moment mad at what you're doing and then like pushing you down. It's because you're not doing what the Lord has commanded. And so what we call that is God's anger. So for example, if you make a golden calf and worship it, and things start not going well, it's not because you made God angry and he got red-faced and he's going to punish you. It's because you have given up God and you started worshiping something else. And we call that God's anger. That's how we make sense of it. Mm. So it appears to us like anger because it opposes God. It's not a good thing. God has graciously given us this analogy, but we shouldn't assume that God was emotionally driven to anger. So he's really condescending when he says things like, I was provoked to anger. That's a really he's condescending to us and showing us it's something like this, but it's not that you were causing me to be like this. It's not like that. It's more than that. So, like I said, remember what Isaac has said several times. When God displays mercy, it's not him changing in relation to us. It's us changing in relation to him. Same thing with anger. Same thing with anger.
I have another example that maybe you could flesh
okay.
out.
Yeah.
So when he, in Genesis 6:5, it said the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intention in the thought of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot man out who I have created from the face of the land.
Yeah.
Bring blood.
Yeah, so you know, same situation. If we want to say that God regretted, we're going to have to say a lot of things. One, that he made a mistake of some sort. So God doesn't make mistakes. So we immediately have to take out the category that he regretted in the same way that we regret. So it has to mean something different. It must mean that in the best way that we understand regretting, God regrets, while also being totally outside of time and not emotionally changed by the situation. I don't know how much further we can go in, you know, answering how that exactly works. But if you want to say that God actually regretted, we have a lot of, you know, you're really tearing apart who God is. So, you know, did he regret in the same way we regretted? No. Did he actively see what's happening and feel like, oh, I don't know about that? No. It's like, I don't even know what it means to regret then, if that's not what you're doing. But they say it's true of God in a way that we just don't understand. I think that's the best way we can answer it and be honest with ourselves. All right, number three. So we looked at, you know, does God have any affections at all? Can he love? What about texts in the Old Testament that say things that make him sound like he's subject to change, emotional change? The third one is, I think this is probably the more common one, is it makes God impersonal, or you could even say dead. In that, if God doesn't experience emotional change, he's totally unaffected by the people in the created order, then he's doing nothing. He's just up there, and there's no anything going on, and it's just impersonal God up there in the sky, whatever. I think that's something that people accuse, people who hold impassibility of it. And I'm not on board with that. There's a lot of reasons why. Matthew Barrett uses an analogy that should help us make sense of this. So he says, imagine your house is on fire. And in this case, it's a woman. She runs out of her house. She saves herself and she realizes, oh no, my children are in that house. And I'm not sure what to do right now. And she looks around and all of her neighbors are just crying in tears. No one can do anything. They're pulling their hair out. They're screaming. And she's like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. And then there's a fireman who, not a tear is dropping from his eye. He's stoic. He runs in the house. He gets your children. He comes out. That is, I think, a helpful way of understanding why God can be impassible. And he is not impersonal and not dead. He's the only one. The fireman in that story is the only one who's not emotionally engulfed in everything that's going on and can't act like he should act. Everybody else is just super subject and overwhelmed by their emotions. The difference is that God isn't actively choosing to be impassible like the fireman is in that situation. Instead, he just is simply impassible. And so you don't want a God who is passable in that way. That is not who you want. In the same way that you don't want a fireman who is totally just emotionally overwhelmed, like, I can't go in there, I'm sorry. This is way too much for me. You do not want that. And you do not want a God who's like that either. You want a God who is impassible, who stands apart from it all, who can see it from the most clear perspective you can see it, and then act in the right way. That is why God is not impersonal and not dead. It is the exact opposite. You know, instead of saying that God is impersonal, this makes God impersonal, what we should actually say is that it makes God personal, personable in a way that's hard to even imagine. Or, in other words, he is maximally alive. Like, we are partially dead and not alive compared to how fully he is alive. Because we can be, you know, we can be affected by emotions and situations and swept up and, you know, kind of overcome, and it's hard to think and things become cloudy and all these sorts of things. God is maximally alive, and that he is outside of it all. He is outside of it all. It doesn't make him less. It makes him infinitely more than we can imagine. He's more alive than we will ever understand. And that's who you want. That's the God who you want, and that's who he is. All right, thoughts or questions on that?
So when my kids were small, I started doing this thing. I wanted them to understand that I love them no matter what. I was proud of them no matter what. And so I would ask them, is there anything you could do to make me love you more? No. Is there anything you could do to make me love you less? No. And the same thing, is there anything you could do to make mommy more proud of you or less proud of you? And the answer is always no. And I would say that to him like all the time. It was like a game we played.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again. Because I wanted them to understand that no matter what they did, that I was gonna love them. No matter what they did, I'm proud of them. Like when they were born, you know, like a 6-pound-8-ounce baby, it's done nothing but make me vomit and cause horrific pain. Like, they hand this baby to me, and I love it more than anything ever, and
yeah.
I'm proud of it, like, so proud. Like, look at my baby, it's done nothing. I'm so proud. You know? But, like, you, as a parent, right, you know, you love your children, you're proud of your children. And so I wanted them to understand that, because I wanted them to know that when you come to me and you tell me something, like, oh, mommy, look what I did. It's like, well, that doesn't make me love them more.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when they do something that's upsetting, that doesn't make me love them less. Doesn't mean I don't experience emotion.
Sure.
But I was always really careful to tell my kids, you know, so when they come to me and say, hey, I got an A on this exam, I wouldn't say, oh, I'm so proud of you. Personally, what I would say is, I'm so happy for you. I know you worked so hard on this. This is awesome. You know, and it's because I wanted my kids to feel that way about me.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted them to understand that my affection and my approval of them was unwavering and unconditional, but not being impassible myself.
Yeah.
You know, I still do experience those highs and lows with
sure.
them in a way that is very human, right?
Yeah.
But I try to separate that off, because there was some part of me as a mother that wanted my kids to know that. And I think that's the part of me that, like, I want to know that God feels that way about me too. And so he doesn't have to experience the highs and lows in the ways that we do humanly, because he sees the whole, he's all the time. But to me, like, as you're talking about this, that's what just keeps coming
yeah.
to my mind, is my desire as a mother, like, I wanted to seem, in a way, impassable to my kids,
yeah.
kind of.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I hadn't thought of that. That's very helpful. I think that helps us make sense of it a lot. All right, so I think I lied about the past one. These are probably the two biggest questions that we have, or you may have. So, number 4, why should we pray if God cannot be moved to do something? What's the point of praying if God cannot be emotionally moved by what we say or what we ask? All right. That question, I think, is probably coming from some sort of misguided understanding of maybe what prayer is. Not totally, but I do think there's probably a part of it that is. So prayer is not, it is not a divine negotiation. But rather, it's a time where God uses our prayers to fulfill his means. So prayer is not a divine negotiation. In other words, we don't go to God and say, God, please, 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 please. And if we hit 100, he's going to be like, all right, I'll do it. You know, there's no amount of begging, pleading that is going to convince God to do something that he wasn't already going to do. Now, that seems, again, that seems like not very helpful in the situation. But let me explain why I think it's way more helpful than what it is. He knows us, he knows our desires, and he knows our needs way better than we ever will. So when we take these things to him, he answers them better than we even understand that he could answer them. And that takes trust. It does take trust. It's not something you can do blindly. You have to trust that he knows you and what you need better than you do. And so if he doesn't answer the prayer in the way that you thought he ought to, the way that he answered it is better. A God who could be emotionally affected by our prayers, that is not a safe place to run. It is not a safe place to run in prayer. In suffering and hard times, you don't want a God who's emotionally affected by you coming to him in prayer. You could say it like this. We need a God who loves us and cares for us enough to give us what we need, even when he knows it's going to hurt us. Because if he knew that it was going to hurt us, and he was saddened by that, and he's like, I really don't want to hurt them, I guess I just won't do what they need. You know, that is hard. That is not what we need. We need a God who sees above it all, who sees clearly, and he says, I know this is going to hurt that person, but it is what they need, and so I'm going to do it. Right? That is an impassable God. And you want an impassable God when you run to him in prayer. More than anything, you want an impassable God. Any thoughts or questions on that?
I can't help but think of the very spiritually deep movie, Bruce Almighty. when he gets frustrated by all the prayers, so he just says yes to everything. And then, like, the world just starts falling apart, like, because, and then Morgan Freeman tells him, when do people know what they really, you know?
Yep.
But, yeah.
No, that's exactly right. That is exactly right.
That's from my dissertation.
That's good. All right. Let's try to get through the Jesus questions, and then maybe concluding thoughts if we have enough time. So, isn't Jesus God, and did he suffer? Yes and yes. So the distinction we have to make here is that Jesus suffered as a man. He suffered as a man. Here's the best way to think about this seeming contradiction. If I were to ask you, did God die on the cross? Kind of a trick question. Okay. In some sense, no. You cannot kill the divine. You cannot kill God. And at the same time, Jesus died. So, what do we say? You killed the man, Jesus Christ, but you cannot kill God. In the same way, Jesus Christ can suffer as a man. That does not mean that the divine God suffers. All right. This is admittedly very confusing. If it's not confusing to you, I would love for you to help me understand it better. I think when we get into a little bit more of Trinitarian language, which we'll have a class on that later on, it'll clear it up a little bit more. Because in some ways, the way we speak of this, we're kind of like defining the persons. It gets really confusing. So the short answer is, Jesus suffered as a man in the same way that he died on the cross. They didn't kill the divine nature, they killed the man. Okay? Natures can't suffer, so it's not just that his human nature suffered. We're not saying that. We're saying that they killed the man because he was human. Does that make sense? In the same way, he suffered as a man. I know it sounds like I'm just trying to get out of like I'm pinned in a corner and I'm just trying to get out of it. I think it's the way the Bible speaks about this as well. That's why he takes on human flesh. He's not getting rid of any of the divine. He's just taking on, and that allows him to suffer and to die as a man, not as the divine. If that doesn't make sense, we can, you know, maybe do some questions afterwards. I think in some ways we're going to be limited here in how we understand this. But the Bible presents us with these two truths, that God is unchanging, cannot be emotionally affected, all these sorts of things, and Jesus suffered. And the best way we can uphold both of these true things that the Bible is saying is the same way we talk about when Jesus died on the cross. You killed the man, Jesus Christ. You did not kill God. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right, so just concluding thoughts here for a second. We have a minute for questions. So God must be impassible for him to be God. If God were passible, then he's no different than us. He's prone to mood swings. He's prone to anger. He can be prone to a lot of different things. He's unpredictable in a scary way. We need a God who is unaffected by the insults hurled at him by those who hate him, and not emotionally driven to sadness when he sees a dog die, right? We don't want a God like that. We don't want a God who's going to get offended by the naysayers. And we also don't want a God who's just like overwhelmed by sadness of simple death on earth, like animals. We need a God who is above and who is outside of it all in a supreme way. A God who is maximally alive, who can send his son not out of compulsion, because then we could say in some part, you know, we necessitated or brought about the coming of Jesus to save us. No, he was not driven to we did not compel him to do it. He just did it out of his loving, perfect being. And he's so emotionally unaffected that he can crush his son, the most violent act ever done, to save us. Because he's not swept up in emotions. He knows the purpose in the end. A God who is true and trustworthy. A God whose word is true and trustworthy. And who will, no matter what, no matter what you do or what I do, will keep us until the end. We cannot make him not do it. He will do it. There's nothing we can say or do. Our God is impassible, and this doesn't make him cold and distant. It makes him God. That is who he is. And there's nothing more that we can ever ask or want of God than for him to simply be who he is. To desire to be, for if you have a desire for God to be passable, you have a desire for him to not be who he is. That's a terrible desire. We want him to be who he is. He can be nothing else. There is nothing more ultimate, more fearful, and more beautiful, or more loving than an impassible God. Nothing more ultimate, fearful, beautiful, or loving than an impassible God. There is nothing, and there never will be. It's who he is. All right. We have a few minutes, not a ton of time, for thoughts and questions or comments. If you disagree with me, anything.
Is there any benefit now, you know, we're in the age of after Christ? A bunch of random thoughts in my brain. That it does give me benefit that Jesus did, you know, the scriptures talk about he was tempted, he was some human, you know, he cried, he showed the emotions, and there's some benefit to that. Obviously, I have priesthood as a believer. I can talk to him. There's so many benefits now where we are today versus before Jesus. Does that matter? You know, do I have it? You know, I'm trying to wrestle with that.
I understand. I think so. He was tempted, and he, in every way that we were tempted, that is something that the divine God knew, but he didn't experience until Christ, if that makes sense. Because God is in, like the divine God, is not subject to experiences. The only way that could happen is if he manifests himself in the incarnate Christ. And so yes, we should definitely be comforted by that. And I think that's why the Bible speaks of Christ being our mediator even. Because Christ knows what it is to be man and knows what it is to be God perfectly, fully. And he's able to mediate these two things, if that makes sense.
So before Jesus, could we still have that same comfort?
Who's that talking? Was Isaac, did I talk about this with you? I asked the same question. I was like, help me make sense of this. You want to answer it again? It was a good answer.
That's one of the ways we stay comforted, knowing that God's not bound by time. So we would say that the saints of old were saved by Christ. They didn't have Christ as a... as we see him in Scripture, presented before their eyes, but by faith they laid hold of what they could not see, as we see in Hebrews. And so in the same way, God standing outside time could relate to his people through the mediation of Christ, though it had not happened yet in time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we're limited. Christ is our mediator, he was also their mediator. We just didn't know as well as we know now. It wasn't revealed to them as clearly.
Right. It seems like a potential pitfall that we could come into is when we think about God being impassible, and then we start thinking about Christ walking in flesh on this earth, we might start to think that, okay, well, the man, Christ, dealt with this, while
the God Christ did not deal with that. And I think there's probably a right way to think about that, and there's definitely a wrong way to think about that, because where my mind tends to go is when he's on the cross and the Father turns his face away, well, is he turning away from the man Christ? Is he turning away from the God Christ? That God is fully man, fully God. How do we deal with that? How do we deal with in the garden when he says, if there's another way, you know, take this one, but yet nevertheless, your will be done. Is that, you know, we don't want to think of it as a dichotomy, but how do we handle God being in the flesh in those circumstances?
Yeah, no, I think those are really hard to make sense of for things far beyond impassibility. So I think the best way you could say it is, it's not that there's ever a divide in who Christ is. It's never his divine nature or his human nature doing something separate. It is by way of God, by way of Jesus being human that he suffers, human that he asks for the cup to pass, those types of things. And it is by way of him being Christ, I mean God, and divine, that he never can be killed at the same time. So it's not that part of Christ is doing one thing or the other. It is by way of him being fully man and or fully Christ, he is able to experience these things totally as Christ. That's about as far as I want to even say that, because I know I'm going to commit like a heresy if I speak any further. Because once you start speaking further, it just gets really confusing and hard. And there's also something about Christ that should be it's a mystery. The incarnation should never stop blowing our minds. Yeah, I'll say it like that.
You know that GIF where someone's staring off into space and there's math equations floating in front of them? That's how my brain feels. I'm trying so hard to make sense of it. But there just hits a point that just like my mind just hits a wall. Like it just has to be faith from this point on, because I can't logic it out.
Yeah, that's right. All right, maybe one more question.
So then, in response to this doctrine, what should be our stance on prayer then? Because I could see where incorrectly somebody would say, "What's the use in praying?" You know, what was the use of like in Hannah and 1 Samuel asking for God to give her a son, and then you know negotiating, if you do this, I'll do this.
Yeah.
What would be a response to that? Because somebody could say, well, there's no use in praying then if we can't, you know, affect God or change his mind.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So something that Tom said one time, he says, if you want to know God's will, listen to the people of the church pray. And I love that quote. And what he means by that is God has orchestrated and the Spirit intercedes, and the words that come out of our mouth that's a way in which God fulfills the ends that he wants to fulfill. We are the means in which he brings about ends. So even if we don't recognize it or know, our prayers, we are praying something that God has ordained to happen before it happened. Before we prayed, I mean. But it appears to us like we are praying. God says, all right, I'll do it. And then he does it. So part of that is him being outside of time, and us being within time, and there's like a, you know, there's kind of like a break. It feels like impossible to meld those two things together. But if just take your concerns and your desires and your needs to the Lord, and he will answer them in a better way than we could ask of him, and it's because he's going to fulfill his ends through the means of our prayer, even if we pray incorrectly and wrong and ask for the wrong things and all those types of things.
Drawing's too deep for words.
Yeah, that's right. I wish we could spend more time, but I've already held you too late, so I can't. If you have more questions, Isaac's going to do a Q&A in 3 weeks. No, but we do have 2 weeks off for Sunday school. So we'll be in the sanctuary the next two Sundays for intern preaching. But so if you do have any questions or thoughts, you can ask me, and then I'll ask Aaron, and then I'll let you know.
What's the next one?
The next one is...
TBD.
TBD.
Nice. That's a deep one.
It is a deep one.
TBD?
TBD. All right, I'll pray for us, and then we'll go. Lord, we thank you for being who you are and for being it completely and fully. And even though I don't understand so much about you, and I never will, I pray that you would give me and give us a heart of trust and a heart that loves you, regardless of how much we understand, comprehend, or can make sense of. And so I pray that as we go into the worship service, we would worship you for who you are.